All right, I'm excited to be preaching for you this morning. So, last week, we left Ruth with a bag full of barley and the promise of more to come as she gleaned safely in the fields of Boaz. So, last week we left off with chapter 2 in verse 23. So, Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. But now, the harvest is ending. Winter is coming. And Ruth and Naomi, they will not have enough to survive that winter. Ruth has essentially been working like a season temp job, a summer temp job, and she just got her final paycheck. And there are no other job opportunities in this town. And there won't be any more job opportunities until the following summer. So it doesn't matter how generous Boaz was when he had his men leaving some bits for her to find and was extra generous at lunch breaks. It was not going to be enough to get them through the entire winter. And wherever they found to live, that wasn't going to last forever either. They were probably couch surfing at friends' places. And no one could afford to keep them with them all winter long. These are mouths to feed, and everybody had to conserve their resources. So Ruth and Naomi's backs were up against a wall. And they were waiting and waiting and waiting for God to do something. Anything. Why wasn't he doing something? Doesn't he see? Doesn't he care? Have you ever been there? Have you ever cashed a paycheck and not known where the next one was going to come from? Have you silently counted down the days until you ran out of money or time for important things to happen? Gosh, this was Lou and I about 9 months ago. One job ended and we had no idea if there was going to be another job or what that was going to look like or when that was going to happen. And we had a certain amount of money and you start to do the math and count down the days and, okay, this is when we're going to run out of resources. And then the what ifs start, right? The what ifs of what if I never find a job? What if I can't pay my bills? What if I have to move? What if something terrible happens? What if, what if, what if, what if? We can what if ourselves to death. Those scenarios, they all run through your head. I'm not crazy. I'm not the only one. Who else has had that happen? Where you're coming up with all of these scenarios for what could happen so that you're prepared, so that you know what decision you're going to make, but it doesn't seem like there's any way that you can finagle it so that it will solve your problem. That was Ruth and Naomi. And they had about 2 whole months to watch the days tick down as first that barley harvest, and then that wheat harvest came to a close. I don't think it is coincidence that it was 2 months, a 60-day period of worrying and hungering for God to come and rescue them. Just like everyone in that community had a 60-day period of hungering as their stores ran out from the last year's harvest and they waited for God to provide a new harvest. Naomi and Ruth were waiting for God to provide a new harvest for them, and nothing. Do you feel their tension? Do you feel their anxiety, their frustration? I think it's so easy to read this as a fun Bible story, and we know it so well, and I love the book of Ruth. But if we really want to understand our Bibles, we need to put skin on these women. They were real women. They had real fears about their very real future. You know they were praying every dang day. God, please help us. Have you ever been in a position where your back is up against a wall and you have no idea what God is going to do? That is where Ruth and Naomi are right now. And Naomi cannot stand the waiting any longer. In chapter 3, verse 1, we read, "One day, Ruth's mother-in-law Naomi said to her, 'My daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for.'" Naomi is essentially saying, "Ruth, I need to find a place for you. You followed me all the way from Moab, and you have been providing for me all of this time. I have to find a place for you to be provided for." Naomi is thinking of Ruth in this moment, not of herself. It's so beautiful. But how on earth does she plan to do that, right? They don't have a patriarch. They are not in a Bet Av. Naomi can't arrange a marriage for Ruth. They don't seem to have any options. So how do you plan on doing that, Naomi? In verse 2, now, this is Naomi still talking. Now Boaz, with whose women you've worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight, he'll be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. So we're going to pause the story, because when the original audience heard that, they knew exactly what was happening. But how many of you know what happened at threshing floors? Great, I'm going to tell you. So, back then, in the little town, there was one threshing floor, usually, for the whole community. And it was sort of like up on a bit of a hill, outside of town a little bit, because it was the place where everybody would go and they would put stuff over top of the grain to kind of work the chaff off of the grain, and then it needed to be able to catch the wind to blow it away. So it was kind of a lonely place, out of town a little ways, a little bit higher up, and there was usually only one pair of oxen for an entire community to share. And so when it came to threshing wheat, you had one threshing floor, you had one pair of oxen, and so everybody had to take turns. So each of the farmers would have a turn where they would take all of their grain from that harvest, and they would have their guys all haul it up there to the threshing floor, and then they would have one long, sweaty day to thresh all of the grain from their harvest from that crop. And so it was Boaz's turn. And so he took all of his guys up there, and they worked all day to thresh all of their wheat for that whole year. And so as they're threshing, they're making a bigger and bigger and bigger pile of this threshed grain. And then when they're finished, they have this massive pile up there, and they're exhausted, and they're happy because this is the whole harvest. They've been working towards this for a long time. And so they celebrate. And they pop a few bottles of wine, and they have a little feast, and they eat well, and they drink well. And then, because this pile of grain is out in a lonely place, and it is the most valuable thing to this whole community, right? It's what's going to feed them until next year. This is like having a pile of gold up there on the hill. So what are you going to do if you're the guy who owns all that? You're going to sleep on it. Because you don't want anybody to come up there and steal it from you in the middle of the night. And so you've had a long day of work. You've had a nice party with your pals. And then if you're the landowner, you go up there and you pass out on your pile of grain to protect it until the next day when your guys can help you then haul it to wherever it needs to go. So Naomi knows all of this, and she knows that tonight it's Boaz's turn. So this is what she tells her to do when she knows that Boaz will be alone, super tired, super happy, bit tipsy, passed out on this pile of grain. This is what Naomi tells Ruth to do. Wash, put on perfume, get dressed in your best clothes, and then go down to the threshing floor. But don't let him know you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. And when he lies down, note the place where he's lying, and then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What exactly are you hoping will happen up there, Naomi? Excuse me. This sounds a little sketch to me. Does it sound a little sketch to you? Okay, the original Hebrew makes it even more sketch. Because when verse 4 says, go and uncover his feet and lie down, the original Hebrew could just as easily mean go and expose a certain other body part and lie with him, if you know what I'm saying. So the author of this book makes it so maddeningly unable to tell what's about to happen. Right, we have two options. It could be mildly suspicious or wildly pernicious, and we don't know what it is. And the author is doing that on purpose. So, if steamy sketchy is what Naomi had in mind, where would she have gotten an idea like this? Like, why would she suggest doing this tonight? Well, I think that she got her idea from Genesis 38, from Tamar and Judah. Do you remember this story? I got to preach on it last time I was here. It was very exciting. Okay, so if we think about the story of Tamar and Judah, it's a very similar situation, actually. Because Tamar is a widow, and her patriarch is Judah, and she's married his first son, but they're still living in Judah's Bet-Av, because they haven't grown big enough to then split off, and, you know, dad hasn't died. So Judah's the patriarch, and Tamar has married the first son. But he dies. So Tamar is a widow, patriarch Judah. And Judah follows the law. Yes, he follows the law that was provided at that time, and he gives his second son to Tamar so that she can have a baby and eventually be provided for and have her own Bet-Av and all of that. It's very important. Well, that second son, he didn't want to do his duty call, and so God killed him because God was very concerned with providing for widows, and this son was not willing to do that. So Judah had a third son, but at this point he's like, maybe it's Tamar is the reason why all my sons are dying. And so he tells her, just wait until he's old enough and then I'll let you marry my third son. But the Bible tells us he was completely lying. So he said, just wait a while and then I'll make it all happen. But in the meantime, I want you to go live with your parents. This was so shameful. Remember, he is her patriarch. She is in his Bet-Av. So he is in control of every decision that she has. So when he says, no, I want you to go and live with your parents again. Her dad couldn't arrange a marriage for her. Her dad couldn't help her. Later in the story, when Judah wants to burn her alive because of what happens, her dad can't do anything about it because he's not her patriarch anymore. Judah is. And Judah is not providing for her. So Judah should be the one who's kinsman redeeming Tamar, but he doesn't. And Tamar waits and waits and waits and waits. And the Bible even says in Genesis 38:12, after a long time, Tamar waits a long time for this patriarch to redeem her and provide for her the way he's supposed to, but he doesn't. So she takes matters into her own hands. She changes out of her mourning clothes, just like Ruth would have. And she gets all dolled up, just like Ruth was supposed to. And then she goes and meets Judah and gets him to have a baby with her. And he doesn't know who she is. Interesting. So it's almost like it's going to happen with Ruth in the night when Boaz isn't going to know who's there. But she had to do it in order to provide for herself, right? She had to. Her back was up against a wall. It was the only way that she was going to be provided for. And so Tamar gets pregnant, and when Judah finds out, he tries to burn her alive. And then when it comes to light that he is actually the one that she had to trick into providing for her, this is what Judah says. Tamar is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son, Shelah. So the Bible praises Tamar as doing the righteous thing by following God's law when her kinsman redeemer shirked his responsibility. So can you see that Naomi, she knows these stories, and she's starting to realize that we've been waiting 2 months, and no kinsman redeemer is taking up responsibility for us. They're shirking their responsibility. I guess maybe God has been waiting on us this whole time to come up with a way to have a baby and create our own Bet-Av, because the kinsmen redeemers in this town are not doing their job. Can you see how she's sort of getting there? So it's a solid plan. Ruth changes out of her widow's clothes, gets stalled up, goes to meet Boaz in the dark, where he won't be able to recognize her when he's feeling happy and sleepy and tipsy. But would Ruth actually do something like that? I think that's the question the author wants us to ask. Would Ruth actually do something like that? We have to decide what we think about Ruth's character. Okay, so we're going to join teams here. I really like teams. So who's on team good girl for Ruth, and who's on team bad girl for Ruth? So we have the option of one. She's actually good she just might make a bad choice because of, you know, bad situation. Or number two, she's kind of bad all along, and she's just been waiting for her true character to come out, and here it comes. So who's on Team Good Girl? Great, yeah, we love Ruth, right? Like, she left her homeland, and she's providing for Naomi, and she's working so hard, and it seems like she is a woman of high character. She's incredible. And so when we see her on the edge of this very sketchy situation, we want to feel like, no, like, don't do that. That doesn't seem like the best option. Like, isn't there anything else that you could do instead? It's kind of like when you have a hero in a movie who's on the edge of making a really bad decision or, like, about to be really tempted by something. And you guys remember in Lord of the Rings when Frodo has this ring and he's like, I don't want it. You take it, Gandalf. And Gandalf's like, I could have it. Like, he's offering it to me. And maybe I'm good enough that I could use this ring for good. And you can, all of it's going through his head, you know? And we're like, no, Gandalf, it'll corrupt you. Like, don't do it. And he doesn't do it. And we're like, yes, because he's really actually a good guy, you know? In a situation where you're so tempted, he made the right choice. So that's how we can think of her. But honestly, I think the original Jewish audience would have leaned a bit more toward she's actually a bad girl, right? Because we have to remember all of the baggage that they have in her head about Ruth. Because she's a Moabitess. She's a Moabitess. And to remember how the Moabite people came to be, another very similar situation. We have Lot, and he's just escaped from Sodom and Gomorrah. And his two daughters, they had fiancés in Sodom and Gomorrah. But Sodom and Gomorrah burned, and her fiancés didn't listen, and so they burned up. And so it's the two daughters and Lot wandering around in the desert, and they're thinking, man, like, once our dad dies, we've got nothing. We have no options. We're widows, essentially, and we're not going to have a bet off. How do we provide for ourselves? What do? We're waiting and waiting for God to come through, and nothing. So they decide, you know what? I have a plan. We'll get Dad drunk. He'll pass out, and we'll have a baby to make a bet of. And we can laugh, but that is a woman's only option. Her only option, if a man doesn't step up, was to somehow get a baby who would eventually grow up to help her. That was her only option. And that was the beginning of the Moabite people. That situation. So the Jewish audience would be like, it's in her blood, man. It's in her blood. That's just what they do. Because when we came through their land generations ago, they did the same thing. They seduced our men, and then there was a plague. They killed 24,000 people because these women, they're trouble. These Moabites are trouble. That is what the original Jewish audience would have leaned when thinking about Ruth. It would have been so hard for them to get that picture of her out of their head. So what is Ruth going to do? Is she going to do it? And we have to remember that this story was originally told through an oral tradition. So we get to cheat, and we get to, like, read ahead of time, and you probably have already read it, and you already know what's going to happen. But when it was originally told, that the audience had to just wait until the storyteller told them what Ruth was going to do. And, oh, this is the moment when everyone's like, what is she going to do? She doesn't seem to have any other option. Verse 5, I'll do whatever you say, Ruth answered. It's like, no, Gandalf took the ring. Like, don't. This is a horrible choice. So she went down to the threshing floor, and she did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay with him. And remember, the audience doesn't know whether it's the lie or lie with him. And I think the storyteller paused a long time, like, and that was that, the end. But then, is that really what Ruth is doing? Is she really bad? Is she still good? What is Ruth's true character when her back is up against a wall and it seems like God is nowhere in sight? Did she take matters into her own hands? Or is she somehow still trusting God? Because the last 2 months, Ruth has been considering her options too. Okay? So she only had two options. Number one, maybe she gets married. Maybe she finds somebody in town who's willing to marry her. But if Ruth got married to someone who wasn't a kinsman redeemer, that guy was not obligated to take in Naomi. Okay? Option B. They wait for the kinsman redeemer to show up and help Naomi. But legally, it's a gray area whether that kinsman redeemer has to help Ruth. So it seems like the only two options available to them aren't a sure bet for both of them together. It is very tricky. So maybe she thought, gosh, maybe Naomi's right. Maybe I do need to be shady to get a baby. Let's find out. So, in verse 8, in the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. Can you imagine that? He's so exhausted. He's so tired. And you're like groggily, open your eyes, and you're like, oh my gosh! First thought, what happened last night? And honestly, we have to remember, this is the time of the judges. He could have taken advantage of this situation, and nobody would have cared. Nobody. Everybody was doing what was good in their own sight. Nobody held anybody else accountable. There is a hot girl at his feet in the middle of the night when he's had a lot to drink. No one would care. Does he take advantage of that situation? No. What he says is, who are you? And this is her reply. I am your servant, Ruth, she said. I love that, like, she doesn't have to explain who she is. She's like, I'm Ruth. You know who I am at this point. She's not, remember that time that I, like, gleaned in your field and you were really nice and you shared your grain with me? It's like, no, I'm Ruth. I'm not Ruth the Moabitess. I'm Ruth, and you know who I am. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. Okay, what the heck is she talking about? Does anyone understand this sentence? Okay, the original audience would have, and so I'm going to explain it to us, because it is like the most epic sentence of this whole book. So we're going to look at the background information so that we too can be like, whoa! Awesome. So just wait. And when it's time, I want you guys to help me out and be like, yeah, this is great. So Ruth says, spread the corner of your garment over me since you are our kinsman redeemer. What is she talking about? This does not sound like a pickup line to me. And she had so many good options too. I had a lot of fun coming up with culture appropriate pickup lines, and I want to share them with you. So no, Boaz, this isn't a dream. It's your dream come true. Or, no amount of barley could bar me from you. Or, now that you're done threshing, you and me can start meshing. Or my favorite one, is that you, Boaz? Because I'd like you to be my beau as soon as possible. But seriously, though, it doesn't sound like a pickup line. We need a little background information. So, the word Ruth uses for covering is the Hebrew word kanaf. Can you guys say it? Kanaf. Kanaf. So, it described both the corner of a garment, so like if you had a cloak or something, the very corner of it, or a wing, like of a bird. So, it could be either of those things interchangeably. And it's actually used a lot in the Psalms to describe God covering and protecting his people. So you probably know Psalms like this. Psalm 36:7, How priceless is your unfailing love, O God. People take refuge in the shadow of your kanaf, or your wings, right? Psalm 57:1, have mercy on me, my God, have mercy on me, for in you I take refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your kanaf. So it was the corner of a garment, it was a wing, and it was deeply associated with refuge for people, protection of them. And in fact, Boaz actually used this same word the first time he talked to Ruth. Back in chapter 2, verse 11, he said, I've been told all about what you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland, and you came to live with a people you didn't know before. May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose kanaf you have come to take refuge. So, Ruth is essentially saying, remember that time when we first met and you prayed that God would reward my faith and integrity with refuge? Yeah, you're a man of God and you're able to give me that refuge. So put your money where your mouth is, Boaz. Like, give me refuge. Don't just pray for me, provide for me. We also need to know that back then, when a man placed a garment over a woman, it meant something culturally. And we see this custom in Ezekiel 16:8. It's God speaking to Israel. And he says, later I passed by, and when I looked at you and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your naked body. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord. And you became mine. And it goes on to describe God clothing Israel with an embroidered dress and fancy shoes and expensive jewelry and a ring and a crown. What does that sound like to you? Someone's entering into a covenant and we're getting really fancy for this covenant procedure. So, when Ruth says, spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family, it is way more than a plea for refuge. It's a proposal. It's essentially like Ruth is getting down on one knee and saying, marry me, dude. So I guess it actually is a pickup line. The most audacious pickup line ever. Marry me. Marry me. Man, this girl is fearless. Fearless. Take that, Taylor Swift. Because a woman, a foreigner, no less, in this culture, with absolutely no social capital whatsoever, is proposing to the most socially powerful man in town. It's not even a leap year. I mean, how could she have been that bold, that brave, that reckless? Because she knows Boaz. He's a man of Hail, remember? So she exhorts him to display that Hail toward her. Ruth expected Boaz to do the right thing because he loved God. Let me say that again. She expected Boaz to do the right thing because she knew he loved God. Do people expect us to do the right thing because they know we love God? Well, Boaz is like blown away by this girl, and he praises her. Verse 10, the Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You've not run after younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of Hail. Wow. Did you catch that? Boaz, the man of Hail, is naming Ruth a woman of Hail. And he tells her that everybody in town knows it too. Ruth is a woman of the highest integrity, the highest character. How did she earn that title? Boaz says, this kindness is greater than the first. well, what is she doing right now that's even better than all of the stuff that she did for Naomi before? He says, you didn't run after younger men. Her greatest kindness is that men were interested in her and would have been willing to marry her, but she did not go after them because she cared more about providing for Naomi than she did about herself. That is character. She's an incredibly high-quality lady. She's always looking out for Naomi above herself. Always. I just want to say that Ruth is not a love story. If it were a love story, Ruth would have skipped off with one of the younger men who was interested in her because she fell in love with them and they wooed her. She did not pursue love or attraction or anything. She pursued taking care of Naomi, even if that meant she had to marry some old dude. I didn't say it. Some old guy. He says everybody else is younger than me. He's an older guy, and that means that he almost certainly already has a wife and already has kids. And it says later that he's not even looking into doing it himself if there's somebody above him. So it's not like he was so in love with her and enraptured by her that he was, like, pursuing her. He was trying to do the right thing. And she was trying to do the right thing. Even if it meant she spent the rest of her life with a man that she didn't love, wasn't attracted to, so that she could provide for Naomi. Ruth is not a love story. It is a Hayil story. A story of what it looks like to have true character, true integrity, even if it costs us something, even if it costs us everything. Ruth is a woman of Hayil, and she displays God's character. And so does Boaz. Instead of treating himself to a fun night with a desperate woman, he chose to pursue a legal way to provide for Ruth and Naomi, and in fact, he'd already been looking into it. The next verses tell us that. It's like, I've been looking into it, and even if the guy in front of me won't do it, then I will provide for you guys. But he's been trying to figure out, why is this guy not stepping up? He's first in line, and we'll talk about that more next week. I don't want to spoil your sermon. But tonight, on the threshing floor, during the time of the judges, when everyone in Israel was doing whatever the heck they wanted, or whatever felt good to them in the moment, Ruth and Boaz didn't sleep together. Yay! They proved themselves to be people of Hayil. Because that's Hayil, doing the right thing, making the right choice, even if it's scary. When everyone else was doing whatever seems best in their own eyes, Hayil is doing what is best in God's eyes. And I don't think it's coincidence that this test of character happened on a threshing floor, the place where the most valuable resource that they had to be put under pressure to let the worthless chaff blow away, to leave what was truly of value. How do we become people of Hayil like Ruth and Boaz? I have two thoughts as I studied this passage. Number one, we are only able to have integrity in the dark if we've had it 1,000 other times in the light. Integrity is something that is built over time with all the little boring, seemingly insignificant decisions in our lives. When we choose to do what God would want, even if it doesn't really seem to matter at the time. Like all the time, at the grocery store, on our lunch break, in the car, when our kids are driving us nuts. What habits have we built? How do we talk to people? How do we respond when we're frustrated? How do we use our money? Like normal stuff, boring stuff, stuff that doesn't seem that monumental. But if we are acting with Hayil, if we are trying to do what God wants in all of the little, tiny, boring decisions of our lives, then when we are up against a wall in the middle of the night, when we are tempted to do anything to save ourselves, we'll act with Hayil and we won't even have to think about it. It'll just be our natural response because that's been our natural response in all of the other insignificant moments of our lives. Okay, number two, we can let our story give us unique eyes for other people. Have you ever wondered how Boaz became such an awesome dude in the time of such a corrupt culture? Like how? How did he become such a great guy who honored God in his work and with his relationships and in this situation? Holy cow. I think Boaz became a man with an eye for the outsider because of his mom. Like Ruth, she was from a foreign land and culture. She, too, was converted to Judaism. She also had an unfavorable title attached to her name. I think Boaz had a special place in his heart for Ruth the Moabitess because his mom was Rahab the harlot. Yep, from Jericho. She was an outsider. And like all outsiders, some people would have welcomed her in, like her husband, Salmon, or Salmon, or however you say his name. But you know that some people never opened their heart to her. You know that, because people are just as human back then as they are today. You know that some people were just plain mean and exclusive toward her and her family and her new husband and her son, Boaz. That kind of unique upbringing would have impacted him. It would have built empathy in him for any outsiders seeking to make Yahweh their new God and Israel their new home. He would have seen firsthand that it is possible for a foreigner to change their stripes and to join God's community. And he would have seen that a woman brave enough to make such a change in the face of criticism and adversity and danger was a strong and faithful woman indeed. Boaz had eyes to see Ruth the Moabitess because he was raised by Rahab the harlot. His life experience, however difficult and painful it may have been at times, gave him the unique ability to empathize with a specific type of person. Who has God given you unique empathy for? Each of our lives is so unique. So unique. We have all experienced such different things. It's really easy to lament or resent the hard things that we have had to endure, or honestly, even the great evils that have been done to us. And even if God never wanted those things to happen and hates that they did happen, he still has the power to transform them into beautiful connections that we can make with other people who have suffered similarly, if we let him. It's a choice. You have a choice when it comes to your story. You can hate your story and resent your story, or you can let God use it to love somebody else in a way that no one else could. All right, let me give you an example. I have always struggled with my weight. So since high school, I have been waging war against my body. Trying to wrestle it into a shape or a number on a scale that I thought was attractive or healthy or honestly just not in pain lately. I've done pretty much every kind of exercise out there, even trapeze, which is really fun. And honestly, I know so much about the human body, it just makes me want to throw up. Like I could tell you about macros and insulin and inflammation and the gut microbiome, and all I've done is like research to try and figure out how to solve my problem. I fast, I eat for my hormone cycle, I practice mindfulness, I've gone on keto, paleo, crazy-o, gluten-free, dairy-free, sanity-free, I've done like every diet. And on my good days, I see my body and my struggle as a gift that God can use. On my bad days, I hate it. But on my good days, I can be attentive to how I have eyes for people who struggle like me. And I can encourage women who have struggled similarly or like are on the verge of having to do a new diet. I had a friend who was a doctor, said, like, for you to live, you have to change your whole diet. She was so overwhelmed. I was like, just come over. Just come over to my house. And we had like cooking days or I would show her how to just cook really simple, super healthy meals because she didn't really know how to cook. And she still sends me pictures, like when she cooks one of the meals that we made together. Like, how overwhelming it is if you've never faced something like that, to have someone come beside you and say, let me help you because I know exactly how you feel right now. Or you have a special way to provide for people. Like, we had a women's retreat, and there was a woman who, gosh, she needed to get away. And she had three little kids, and, you know, that season is just like... So she needed time with the Lord to come on the Silence and Solitude retreat, but she was having some major health issues and had to follow a super strict diet. I was like, you know what? Give me every specification of that diet. I don't care how crazy you sound. And I will cook all of the food to that so that you don't have to think about that while you're on this retreat. And she came, and she wasn't sick during our retreat, and she got to spend time with the Lord when she wouldn't have been able to otherwise. Like, there are pieces of your story that I'm sure you hate. But how can God use that for you to see someone else? For you to love someone else? Because if we let God use the pieces of our story that we hate to give us eyes for someone else, that is how we can build Hayil. That is how we can show God's character to other people. I think Boaz did that for Ruth. And honestly, Ruth did that for Naomi. Like, Naomi suffered, and she literally looked at the pieces of her story and got bitter and renamed herself bitter. I hate this. I hate this. God's cursed me. Ruth lost all of the same people. And she used that loss to propel her into special ability to empathize with Naomi. Ruth could have just as easily gotten bitter. But she didn't. She used that to propel her to love in a way that no one else was able to love Naomi because no one else had experienced what she had except for Ruth. That's Hayil. I mean, what's your story? And who has God given you the unique ability to notice? Ruth had Hayil. Did you know that the only other woman in the whole Bible to be named a woman of Hayil is the Proverbs 31 woman? And in most of the Hebrew Bibles, Proverbs comes right before the book of Ruth. So you have Proverbs ending with this beautiful poem about a woman of excellence, a woman of integrity. Talks about she's more precious than jewels. People can trust her. She works hard. She's smart. She's strong. She has dignity. She's wise. She's kind. And she fears the Lord. This incredible description that women, since the beginning of the Bible, have held up as like, this is who we need to be. Sometimes it's intimidating. And then you're like, she had servants, so she didn't do it all on her own. But that's another sermon for another day. But she's held up as this pinnacle of womanhood. Biblical womanhood. And then you have God inserting into the Hebrew Bible the story of Ruth. An outsider, a Moabitess who was held up to the same pinnacle of womanhood as this girl. Gosh, that must have been humbling. Should be humbling for us. This little book of Ruth should humble us and inspire us. She was an outsider, but she was displayed more of the character of God to others than any other woman in the nation of people professing to believe in him. She wasn't born into a God-fearing family. She wasn't born into a nation under God. She wasn't an Israelite. But she acted more like God than all of them. Are we people of Hayil? Do we make decisions that honor God and other people in the light and in the dark? Do we see our stories and our struggles as an opportunity to love uniquely? And what do we do when our back is up against a wall? In the book of Ruth, we see that we have a choice. We always have a choice to do the God-honoring thing. And when we make that choice, it builds in us a heart of Hail, a heart like God's heart that we can share with the world. Can we choose today to be people of Hail? Let me pray for us. Father, thank you for this incredible story of Ruth. Man, she inspires me. I pray that she would inspire all of us to love other people in a way that is just insane, putting her entire future on the hold to help someone else. Lord, I pray that you would build that in us, that you would show in me and in us the ways that we're not living according to your ways and honoring you. And I pray that you would give us strength to make God-honoring decisions, even if we feel like we have our back up against a wall. Lord, show us, reveal in me the ways that I am not loving you well, that I am not loving other people well. Please help us to do that more, as we know how much you love us. I pray all of this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Church, I'm going to invite you to stand. If you're able, we're going to respond together in worship.